Welcome back to the Poor Pearl's Almanac, back and fruitier than ever.
Finally.
Today we're talking we're talking plums. Beach plums, specifically.
I don't know how I feel about plums on the beach. Like sand and fruit. That's like just biting into something gritty.
Sand is like nature's filler. It's like corn, but inedible.
Like the geographic equivalent of corn.
Yes.
Or the geological. I don't like that very much.
This episode brought to you by concrete. Yes, concrete.
That's concrete, baby.
What was that accent?
You haven't seen that one?
I have not.
Of the dog?
No.
Wow. Speaking of memetic formats.
I know. I'm getting old, man. I'm losing touch with the meme culture.
I'll look it up when you're doing one of your monologues.
Okay. So, for real, we are talking about the beach plum or Prunus maritima. Maritima? One of those. I'm not good at Latin. Don't judge me. So, it's one of the several plums that are native to what you might consider modern-day North America. The beach plum is a bit of a unique one in that it grows in poor, sandy soils and has a really high capacity for controlling erosion. The native beach plum is commonly found across the coasts of the northeastern United States, but it actually ranges from up to Newfoundland down to North Carolina. Unsurprisingly, as a beech tree, and I'm using tree very loosely here, it was one of the first New World plants that colonists saw when they came ashore in the 1600s, but it was even documented by Italian explorer Giovanni da Verrazzano, who referred to them as damson trees in 1524. While indigenous groups did harvest the fruit across the coast, there doesn't seem to be much evidence of any management or documentation of processing from early settlers.
So we're not going back like 12,000 years in this episode, are we? Is this like an ice age?
We are not going back to scrat. Sorry, buddy. Not this episode. I'm
bummer.
Heartbroken. Yes. But it wasn't our good buddy Giovanni who discovered the plums or wrote about it early on. Several people, including like Henry Hudson, you know, the dude who the Hudson River is named after, he described the shoreline as being covered in beach plums, which again may or may not have been actually managed by indigenous people. We just don't really have any documentation about it. In 1785, continuing the descriptions of this unique plant, a guy named Humphrey Marshall described it as the seaside plum, which was known to have like incredible amounts of flowers, but didn't produce much fruit, and actually was sold or brought to Europe not as a fruit, but as a landscaping plant.
Mm.
It was like, oh, look at this little shrubby thing that has like tons of flowers and maybe sometimes produces fruit. What makes this tree, or I'm going to keep calling it a tree, but it's really sort of not. What makes it really interesting is that it's incredibly diverse. In 1872, the American Agriculturalist, a very big newspaper at the time for people that are interested in agriculture, I know, shocking, described it as, in quote, "The fruit varies in different plants, not only in color and size, but in quality, some specimens being quite pleasant to the taste and others harsh and acerb." Unlike many native fruits, the beach plum's extremely diverse set of genetics has caused a lot of challenges with improving the fruit and also causes the tree bush to vary in size significantly, vary in fruit size, flower size, color, adaptability, flavoring, skin thickness. The diversity, it almost appears to be like a different plant with the capacity for its genetic diversity.
Yeah, I mean, there's not like a whole lot of fruits that can range from like delicious with one color to like gross at another one. I mean, apples are kind of the only one I can think of, really.
Yeah, basically. And despite this challenge, several attempts were made during the 19th and 20th centuries to develop beach plum cultivars with consistently good fruit qualities. Despite this, as of 1900, only three cultivars were identified, and their names are just like chef's kiss. It's Basset, Alpha, and Beta, which have all since been lost.
A plus work, everyone. Again.
Yeah, this seems to be a repeat story for the development of native crops, where they do some work, people identify them, and then everyone's just kind of like, fuck it.
Honestly, it's almost impressive.
Our ability to screw up our own work is just unmatched. Now, the government decided it was a worthwhile crop to improve as well, and despite the work of the Soil Conservation Service, with folks like J. Milton Batchelor, who scouted for high-quality varieties to bring into production, little progress was made at first, but the beginnings of change were becoming present. And this, unsurprisingly, I know this is going to be a wild shock to our listeners that have been listening for a long time. This was driven largely by a guy named Liberty Hyde Bailey.
No way! LHB!
Right?
Our favorite guy!
He wrote a book called The Cultivated Native Plums and Cherries, which was the first real scientific work on these fruit, and in it he also identified 140 cultivars of native plums. I say native plums, I'm talking about not just beech plums, but other ones like Chickasaw and so on, which I was really torn about this episode if I wanted to do Chickasaw plums or beech plums as an episode, but I felt like beech plums don't get enough love, so that's why we're doing that one. And then I thought it was too much to do two different plums in one season. Like, there's a lot of content we need to cover. Doing plums next to plums is just too much. The fruit's too sweet.
Yeah, I think that was the right call. I don't think we can do plums on plums.
Stacks on stacks. After Bailey wrote this book, and then following the Hatch Act, which we've talked about in the past, more than 70 bulletins were dedicated to the study of native plums and cherries, including the beech plum. Researchers and breeders, primarily in the northern Great Plains, which is one of the hotbeds of native plums here in the United States for genetic diversity, and as you may have noticed in this series this season, we've spent a lot of time talking about how this region of the country seems to have a lot of improved varieties, and that's interesting, and we could talk a lot about that, but we're not going to right now. But it was in this area they were collecting and identifying the best genetics for native plums. And during this period, right after the book, the late 19th century, they introduced more than 100 varieties of native plums that had otherwise not been identified before he wrote this book.
Wow. Thank you, Liberty Hyde Bailey. You know, we should really feel like we've brought him up a few times now. We should really do an episode on him.
Mr. Bailey, he deserves his own episode?
I think so.
Maybe two?
Even better.
Even better.
Double the Bailey.
Double the Baileys. A double shot of Baileys in my coffee in the morning. It's the way to do it.
Yep. That is a hint, though, fellow listeners. Not Andy's drinking. But that we did do a few episodes, like, I don't know, like 10 months, a year, something like that ago on Liberty Hyde Bailey. And we keep bringing him up because, well, he was kind of involved in all the stuff that we love to talk about.
He was a king, is what we're saying. Absolute king. Like, I don't believe in kings, but if he was like, I should be king, I would have been like, yeah, okay, that's fine. I get it.
Yeah, you got a point.
Now, unsurprisingly, given Bailey's background, he led much of the research, and he spent a considerable amount of time at a guy named Jonathan Kerr's orchard, known as Eastern Shore Nurseries in Denton, Maryland. And while he was there, he researched every variety he had in what was likely the most extensive trial on native plums in North America. Now, despite the hype by growers and breeders and researchers like himself around, like, native plums, the biggest challenge has always historically been that the skins are astringent despite the fact that the flesh inside is very sweet.
You know, they kind of say that about our show.
We're astringent but sweet on the inside?
Well, and by astringent, I mean hard to listen to because of the bad jokes.
There are no bad jokes. There's just dad jokes, all right?
I mean,
respect the dad joke.
No, it's just okay. It's just the ones you find funny.
Now, despite all of this breeding work, by 1911, there were only 5 named varieties. Fortunately, our buddy Milton Batchelor that I mentioned earlier wasn't the only researcher backed by the Soil Conservation Service. Another guy with a great last name, John Pennypacker.
Whoa.
Right? He was sent to scour the East Coast, flying over dunes in 1913 to identify the beech plums while the bloom was in season to collect genetics for future research.
Excuse me, did you say, like, flying?
Yeah. You know, have you seen The Mummy?
No.
Is that too old for you?
A little bit.
Oh, my God. Ugh. The way I envision this is in The Mummy, they get on this, like, old British plane, like, probably about this era, and because it's a two-seater, the other guys have to hold on to the wings while it flies. And, like, that's how I know it's not true, but that's how I imagine this happened. Like, they were basically flying around, like, super low so you could, like, spot the blooms. And they were literally just flying over the coast looking for anywhere that had blooms when they were in season so they could be like, okay, these are all the spots. Send people there. And he did it up the entire fucking coastline.
Damn. I mean, aerial botany, that's some pretty intense stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he must have been flying, like, all over the place.
He must have been packing, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Penny Packer was packing?
Mm-hmm.
He was penny packing.
I wasn't gonna say that.
But here we are.
But here we are.
And, like, the thing about it is, like, it's not like you're just flying over and, like, oh, I'm just gonna go up the coast over the course of, like, a week. Like, you have to time that with all the subtleties of the ecosystems and their variations and temperature swings based on microclimates and all this other stuff. And he did all of it. And then, I think it was 1913. I forgot to write the year. It's either 1913 he did it or 1913 when his thesis came out. I can't remember which one. But he wrote this thesis for the University of Pennsylvania, and in it he identified 8 varieties of beach plum that were taken from basically Maryland up to Massachusetts. And again, this is writing a PhD thesis after flying in a plane and identifying plants and then collecting them before GPS is just wild.
Also, like, back when planes were notoriously reliable and safe.
Exactly. Like, that's a true dedication. You're like, there's a 30% chance I die if I get on a plane 6 times. And he was like, hell yeah, let's do it for the plums.
For the plums. It would have been so much nicer, like, imagine doing, like, airship botany. not all that dangerous stuff, just kind of floating around.
Right. I know. Where was this technology when Liberty Hyde Bailey dragged his wife into the fucking swamps to find a palm tree?
Oh, yeah. What was that, Panama?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's either Panama or Colombia. And his wife's like, I'm so glad you're retired. I'm glad you don't, like, why don't you know anything about these palm trees? Like, I'll fucking show you a palm tree. That's my favorite story that we've done in this entire show ever, is him dragging his 80-year-old wife into the fucking swamp to show her, or to, like, find this, like, rare extinct palm tree. It's the best.
Yeah, it is.
So anyways, let's put this into context a little bit, the early 1900s, right? So we had talked about a couple weeks ago with the blueberry episode, like, the development of the canning industry.
Right.
And, like, how it was, like, very contingent on, like, filling that gap for canners to make, basically be like, well, we've got these fruit, let's keep our production line busy. Even if we're not making a ton of money, it's still eating up our fixed costs and so on. And these folks were basically like, this is going to be the next blueberry. You know, the railway, canning, people just found out about this other cool new fruit called blueberry. Let's give them another one. And they were like, heave-ho, this was going to happen. But instead, a lot of researchers, breeders, especially those tied to, like, bigger industry, decided that the best use of the American plum was to develop hybrids, which would give the European plums, which really struggled here in North America, the resistance of native plums and the flavor of European plums. Now, a guy named Luther Burbank, you may recognize that name, he led the charge on this, including the now famous Santa Rosa plum, which still to this day dominates the industry.
I mean, you gotta hand it to him. The man bred a good plum. Also, where have we seen his name before? Because that does sound familiar.
I don't think we've talked about him in the show, but he's a fairly recognizable breeder. He did a lot of cool shit.
Gotcha.
Maybe we could do an episode on him.
Cool shit guy.
Cool shit guy. We have a lot of cool shit guys in the show. Mm-hmm. Check it out. We should just rename the show the Cool Shit Guy Show.
No.
No? You don't like it?
No.
You're plumb tired of this idea?
Oh, fuck. Jesus.
All right. So anyways.
Christ. How long have you had that one in the chamber?
I've I've been trying to figure out how to use a plum joke on this show for this episode since we started recording. And I was thinking about like talking about something being plum, like straight. And I was like, I think that's too niche, but I could do the old man plum joke. So that's what I went with.
That's the one you went with. I mean,
that's the one I went with.
I really think you're going out on a limb here.
Well, that's where the best plums are. The sweetest fruit, Matt. Come on, keep up. Now, anyways, our buddy J. Milton Batchelor, who we mentioned a few moments ago, was assigned to the Hill Culture Division of the Soil Conservation Service to travel the North Atlantic coast area in the 1930s, despite the fact that it had already been clearly covered and combed thoroughly by plane.
Of course.
And in this time, he actually found three new named varieties, only one of which continues to exist for this day. On this trip, he found Hancock, which was found in Fort Hancock, New Jersey, had blue fruit and really early maturity. It's believed to have been since lost, but there are murmurings that it may still exist today. We're going to get to that in a moment. Another one's called Safford, which was found on Plum Island in Massachusetts, and had very heavy bearing fruit. And then there was also Premier, also from Plum Island, which, I mean, obviously, Plum Island is going to have some good plums. Like, you don't fucking name Plum Island because they're like, hey, that's the place with the fucking shitty plums. Don't eat them. So Premier was supposed to have, like, the best flavor, but super poor resistant to brown rot.
And, okay, so this was, like, right? This was, like, during the peak permanent ag movement. So everyone was, like, kind of hyped up about tree crops, right?
I mean, very relative word, everyone, but yeah. Basically.
Yeah, but like everyone.
Everyone that was cool, you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
The only people we're talking about. You can see the Conservation Service, based on what we've been talking about, was investing heavily in tree crops and the research to find the best genetics that we saw with like pawpaw and honey locust and blueberries. And they were testing out the waters on the beech plum as well.
Man, I want to go back. I mean, I don't. For obvious reasons, but also, like...
I mean, once you get past, like, the racism and homophobia...
The disease.
And, I guess, the impending world war.
Yeah, and the ecological collapse.
And the fears about the fall of agriculture.
Yeah, you know, maybe it's not that much different from now.
That sucks. So, speaking of the increased research at this time, though, a few other citizen researchers... whatever you want to call them, like local plant people, started identifying other varieties, some of which are still in cultivation today. A guy named Wilford Wheeler identified Eastham out of Eastham, Massachusetts. I'm basically reading where these are from because I think it's dope as hell that they're like places within driving distance for like an afternoon for me.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, everyone. We're talking heavily about Massachusetts today. It's my day in the sun.
Jesus, God help us.
Yeah, watch out. Now, our buddy Wilford Wheeler also had several other selections that have since been lost, but Eastham is still out there. One of which was supposedly really good was Wheeler's selection number 6 from Truro, Massachusetts. He also had another one called Arrowhead, Snow, and a few others that I won't bother naming. And another fella that, who am I?
This fellow...
this fellow. Another guy that was also, busy doing the beach plum thing was a guy named J.H. Putnam. He found the one that they call Putnam.
No way.
In Orleans, Massachusetts. I know, right? Surprising. I figured that was a Penny Packer pick.
Mm-hmm.
The PPP.
Ugh.
Need me a PPP loan. No, I was waiting for some kind of reaction for that.
Fine. I don't know. It was good. Topical for sure.
It's topical. Now, Putnam was described as an unusually large, promising, and well-flavored plum. Again, where it may be, we may never know. Now, the New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station also released one called a Rarabank, and this was selected from the wild near Old Bridge, New Jersey, which makes excellent jelly and is still available to this day.
Man, that honestly sounds pretty nice. I mean, minus the New Jersey part, but like a little beach plum jelly.
Beach plum jelly, and there that is available in stores. We're going to talk about that probably next week.
Oh.
Back in the Permanent Agriculture series, we talked about how the movement died during and after World War II for a number of reasons. The short version is America stopped giving a shit about anything but winning in war. Then they needed to retool their entire military system and realized they could grow food with it. So basically everything else was a giant fuck you.
And the long version of that is about 10 episodes this podcast.
Yeah. I went real deep on it.
Yeah, about 20 hours on there.
Like, if your uncle or your friend is, like, getting into weird World War II history and you're like, oh, no, this is how they become conservative, go send them that way instead.
Yeah.
While this shit was going on, folks in the beach plum industry were not pushed out of the limelight. Well, they did not lose their interest. They did not lose the little bit of power they had. And it was largely because of this guy named George Graves. He was a horticulturalist who had worked extensively with beach plum. He also worked with a bunch of other underappreciated plants. One of note, which I just find fascinating, was poison ivy.
I mean, honestly, shout out to anyone that's trying to, like, grow improved poison ivy for, like, good or evil. I support it.
Like, plant selection, but to make plants worse.
Scarier.
Then you put them in your enemy's yard. Yeah. Like, how do we make this poison ivy, like, sentient?
Put spikes on it, too.
Yeah, like, make it heat sensing. So, like, it grows towards where people are or something. Like, there's so much you could do with it.
Unexpectedly drops from the canopy.
You've created, you know,
like a predator.
Yeah. Preda plant. We can do it. They can help. Breeders. Anyways, so our buddy Graves.
Shout out villain plant breeders.
Shout out to the villain plant breeders. You're the real heroes.
They're probably listening to this.
They are absolutely listening to this. They're our biggest fans. Now, our buddy Graves, not only was he into beach plums, he also managed the Massachusetts Agricultural Experiment Station, where he worked on developing better roadside plantings, representing more of the diversity of the American landscape. And at the time that Graves was writing about how great the beach plum is, that we should be using it more as a landscape plant, very much like the Liberty Hyde Bailey, like, ornamental native thing, the Harvard's Arnold Arboretum and the University of Massachusetts collaborated with the intent of formalizing the development of a small fruit industry on Cape Cod. Because if you don't know, Cape Cod's got lots of tourism, but otherwise is pretty fucked up. That's kind of mean, I'll say.
Yeah, fuck Cape Cod. you heard it here first on the Poor Pearl's Almanac.
No, it's very limited for opportunities if you don't want to work in tourism. So creating an agricultural system that, like, anyone with limited education can, like, work a meaningful job and all that was of concern in Massachusetts. So this little collaboration worked to identify some cultivars which were selected. They did a lot of research on disease and pests. Propagation was researched. And it was basically like, how do you build an industry out of this plant? Now, given the fact that Cape Cod is largely a sandy mass of land, home to one of the largest rare pine barren ecosystems on the coast, it's not surprising that then this very sandy beach next door on both sides of this weird peninsula is often covered in wild beach plums. In finding selections that could grow in these otherwise inhospitable regions with consistently good fruit could revolutionize the wild beach plum industry and help provide employment in this region.
Okay, so, and jump in if I'm wrong here, but what you're saying, what you're advocating for is bulldozing the Pine Barrens and setting up massive beach plum ranches.
That's, no, you got it. No notes.
That's all I needed to hear. I have the PPP loans ready. I have... I'm so excited to bulldoze a rare ecosystem.
The Pennypacker pick loans, we got them. Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
I'll be deleting all of my anti-permy content tonight, and I got an appointment tomorrow. I'm getting Bill Mollison's portrait tattooed on my ass.
Oh, man.
It's going to be great.
I'm so excited. And listeners, our permaculture design course will be online shortly for the cost of $2,400.
And it's fully online.
Fully online.
Not seeing you in person.
Asynchronous. It just unlocks a YouTube. It just unlocks a YouTube playlist.
That's just like a really poorly made PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of video essays.
With like systems thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so in 1949, a guy named James R. Jewett, a professor emeritus of Arabic at the Harvard University, the one and only Harvard University that you may know by its funding of beach plums research only a few years earlier. He was also a seasonal resident of Cape Cod, and he gave the Arnold Arboretum $5,000 to establish a fund to develop beach plums or other native fruit-bearing trees or shrubs. Fortunately for him, beach plums are both trees and shrubs.
So says you.
So says me. We're going to get there, I promise. There were two prizes, one for 100 and another for 50, which would be awarded annually to the residents who had done the most to improve the potential of the beach plum. Now, the first two prizes were awarded in 1941 to Cape Cod residents Mrs. Wilford C. Smith and Mrs. Ina S. Snow. An art teacher by day, Mrs. White wasn't just interested in the native plants of Martha's Vineyard where she lived, but dedicated her free time to teaching Wampanoag kids to be proud of their history, offering free weekly pottery classes to those same kids.
Aw, that's cute. A pottery class.
Very, very wholesome woman, right? While Mrs. White was busy teaching, in her free time, she conducted experimental beach plum plantings and successfully petitioned the Massachusetts legislature for funds for beach plum research to be conducted at our buddy Graves' agricultural experiment station, and she was allocated $500, which is like, I don't know, $5,000 today.
Damn. Wholesome pottery person by day, whole pain in the ass to the government by night.
My kind of woman. All right, so what are we talking about? We're talking about our buddy Bertram, which we have not talked about yet.
Yeah, okay. Hit me with Bertram.
Bertie, Bert. Mm-hmm. Bertram Tomlinson goes by many names. Maybe. We don't know. He was the Barnstable, and for those of you that are not in Massachusetts, Cape Cod County Agricultural Agent.
It's not Barnstable.
It's not Barnstable, Matt. It's Barnstable. Come on. you're not that far away. You should know better. Mm-hmm. Now, he was alongside our buddy George Graves, the founding members of what became the Cape Cod Beach Plum Growers Association, which was officially formed on November 17th, 1948, which White and Snow would later join. The group started a registry of beach plum varieties to help drive development of the best yielding plants and frequently put out bulletins to highlight new findings around beach plums.
Honestly, that's cool as hell. I mean, is this like how... Is it still around?
Unfortunately, no. Bulletin number 11 appears to be the last bulletin put out, which was while a guy named John C. Hammond was president. Now, Hammond is a very interesting figure. You're not going to find him on Wikipedia. You have to go down some real rabbit holes to learn about this guy, which, you know, that's kind of my thing. I like a good rabbit hole.
Oh, man, we're going off Wikipedia.
Oh, this whole episode is off Wikipedia, basically.
It's all like, a podcast.
70% of this is not on Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, to backtrack. So I was talking about like our buddy White, Miss White. I found a news article from like 1924 talking about her doing this pottery thing. That is where I found it. No one else has written about it. You get the hottest uncut content here, mm-hmm. like no one else.
Unbelievable. I'm sidetracked. The beach plum goss that we're spilling
here. I am. The beach plum goss. All right. I'm plum out on this content.
Mm. No.
No? It's okay, fine. So Hammond, he obviously was very passionate about beach plums, but he was also invested like financially in the cranberry industry, which is the other big thing around here, and oyster production. Because of his closeness to oyster harvesting, he had very early on noted the warming climate as it was impacting the oyster industry and how they were able to, like, produce.
This dude was like, do not fuck with my oysters.
Yeah, basically. He was like, cranberries and oysters must be fall. No, you don't get that joke. I'm sorry.
No, what, is that a reference to something?
Yes. There's frogs and cranberries must be fall. Have you never seen those memes?
No.
Okay. All right. Different part of the internet.
Look it up.
It points to the fact that he had like this really good sense of how things related to one another. And he had some really insightful things he was saying back at this time in the 50s that at the time he couldn't prove, but he was like very clearly like on to something. He once said that, and quote, "The plums that grow on sandy land are sweet, mild, and luscious. away from the beach and swampy ground and good pasture land, in scrub oak woods and good soil in the perennial border, beech plums grow, making a fine show of their feathering blooms, but in most cases when the bushes grow in fair to good soil, the fruits are extra full of tannin content and pucker. They do not make as good a jelly. In fact, some refuse to gel, and the plums are not as good to eat out of hand as those from the beachy sands, end quote. While yet to be proven, he believed that the source of tannin came from nearby oak leaf litter and soils with high amounts of nutrients created poorer fruit. A comment that's supported anecdotally by beech plum growers. A guy named Dr. Tim Vissell has clarified this based on more contemporary research, pointing out that, in quote, I think that the substance or factor he was looking for included undigested leaf wax or paraffin residues. That would explain the changing condition of wet terrestrial soils subjected to oak leaves in the presence of sulfur-reducing bacteria, and perhaps the declines he observed in beech plum yields over time.
So he was right?
Maybe. Sort of. We don't actually know. People today do use fertilizers, so it's not the nutrients themselves at the very least. But there's probably something to the tannin component of it. But to get back to the organization, the trials and experiments ultimately did not materialize and the association declined. Our buddy George Graves continued researching without the association, registering beech plums through the 1950s. At the time, only a few new beech plum varieties were named. One variant, coincidentally called the Graves beech plum, named after a different Graves, Dr. Charles B. Graves in 1897, existed, according to a New York Times article, only on one site in Groton, Connecticut.
Woo! Shout out Groton.
Shout out to Groton. You've got this tree, or you did until 2000, which then it had died. So there goes the extant wild population. Good job, Groton.
Bummer, Groton. Okay, so let me just get this straight. There were two guys, both with the last name Graves, unrelated, both researching beech plums.
Yeah, it appears to be the case. Hey, Matt.
Yeah.
It's a grave situation. It's great. Get it?
And you know I hate it here. You know I hate it here.
Get it? Okay. It's really what I'm here for. I don't even really care about this content. It's the puns.
Yeah.
I'm really here for the puns.
All the episodes are just an excuse for slipping in like 10 or 12 puns.
In my daily conversations, yes. Now, if it's not clear at this point, the tree itself thrives in seaside conditions. It grows in these very low nutrient, high wind, unstable substrate, and high salt levels that most plants that we talk about on the show could never survive. There are excellent trees for erosion control, and alongside the eastern prickly pear and American beech grass and Virginia rose, they can create an edible landscape in even the harshest conditions. All of these traits make the beech plum uniquely adapted for many of the challenges we're going to face under climate change.
Okay, so we're going to forget brat summer and we're on to beech plum fall. Get your shovels out.
Now you're catching on. We noted that the beech plums don't like nutrient-rich soils or extensive fertilizers. They will thrive and produce better crops in terms of volume with soils with some organic matter and limited fertilizer, although again, not necessary for their survival. They're also considered self-fertile, but like many self-fertile plants, will set better fruit with cross-pollination. Now, in the poor soils, like when you're thinking about like a beech dune that is just sand, the beech plum will stay like really shrubby and almost will never break 10 feet, and usually, to be completely honest, are only a few feet tall, which is why I was like, they're more like bushes than trees. But if they're in improved soils, they can grow up to like 20 feet tall. So they can like become a tree. It's just not like something they're normally going to do. One of the cooler things that I did learn when I was reading about these trees is that because they're on dunes, they've adapted to like rapidly changing sand heights, and their lower branches often become covered with sand, and then they just basically get converted into roots.
Oh, we just like a potato.
It's like a potato, yeah.
Just like a potato. Who would have thunk it?
The perennial potato.
That's the dream. That's what we've been searching for.
It is. One of the largest challenges, much like many tree crops, is consistent production. Beech plums rarely produce year over year in similar volumes. like many of our other fruits, they have heavy fruit production in one year, and then there's very little resources for flowering for the next year. Historically, with all the crops that we grow for food now, that's managed with like soil amendments. But given the beech plum's dislike, we'll say, for intensive soil amendments, I don't see this really solving this issue for this plant. Now, Dr. Richard Uva, the world's foremost expert in beech plum and the only beech plum orchardist that I know of that actually sells produce to market, like at scale, advocates for an orchard design that focuses on 12-foot rows where the trees are planted 5 feet apart. So if you have just been plum-pilled out there, mm-hmm. the penny picker plum-pilled, I can't believe I pulled that off in one shot.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Right?
Clubbed that.
Then this is what you got to do. This is Mr. Uva, Dr. Uva's got your instructions for building your future beech plum orchard. We're going to give them to you right now.
So take notes.
Take notes. You space them out, like we said. You can take cuttings or you can propagate with seed, but obviously seeds can have different genetics. Cuttings should be 4 to 6 inches in length, taken from non-fruiting branches. You do need root-inducing hormones. And like most cuttings, they should be kept in humid, warm conditions. Alternatively, you can take root cuttings. So if you see a really cool tree and it doesn't look very big, see if you can take like 3 to 4 inches from the root in the late fall and place it horizontally in the soil outdoors, cover with straw. Congratulations. It's a baby. It's a baby plum.
So hit the beaches, everyone.
GTL.
Get out and find some plums.
Maybe not right now. It's a bit cold for that.
Okay, next summer, hit the beaches, collect the plums, plant the seeds.
Plum planting, penny packer plum planting. Generally, good life advice. Now, let's fast forward a little bit. In the early 1990s, the USDA Soil Conservation Service released a new variety of beech plum called Ocean View, which was field tested from North Carolina to Maine. The current location of these plants doesn't seem to be public, and there doesn't seem to be any evidence of it being sold to the public after the first announcement.
I mean, is that because like it didn't do well or just because no one wanted it?
Probably the latter, but we don't actually know because as we've talked about in the show, like these fruits kind of like ebb and flow where people are interested and then they lose interest.
Mm.
And they were just kind of ahead of the curve of the new interest. And that new interest came in right around George Bush and 9/11. So happy 9/11, everyone.
Jesus.
The beech plum got its second chance. Yeah, the early 2000s showed a rekindling of research primarily out of Cornell, UMass, and New York. The UMass Cold Spring Orchard Research and Education Center grew 150 seedling plants from 14 sites in 2003. At Cornell, Dr. Uva has been focused on identifying the best beech plums as well as building the best, like, how to using his own orchard for people that want to work with these plants. For context, as it stands today, the best beech plums can produce 4,000 pounds of fruit per acre compared with 6,000 by blueberries at the same acre.
Okay, but like not consistently though, right?
Correct. So there's still like a lot of work to be done.
But nothing like kind of like crazy.
No, researchers that do work with this plant kind of describe it as like halfway to domestication. So like a lot of the legwork has been done. It's about consistency, if you can find consistency. Although I would imagine that you're going to end up with much of a cultivar situation. The same way like we have apples, right? Where you can take a seed out of a Honeycrisp and it's going to be probably a trash apple, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for these guys, it'll be about just finding that collection of genetics that is good. That is your future industry, right? To continue, in the spring of 2003, down in Connecticut, 210 beech plum seedlings were planted by Dr. Abigail Maynard at Lockwood Farm in Connecticut. These seedlings were raised at Cornell University from seeds collected from 35 sites from Maine to Delaware. Growers back in the early 2000s were taking cuttings from the best individuals to be propagated. Now, not much has seemed to happen since this research in 2003. But I can say that these selections that were identified are known as Yukon 49, 64, 111, and 142.
Catchy.
Catchy, right? So they're out there is my point, right? And like, you know where to find what they're called. And if you're researching beech plums and you see these, this is what that's from and what that's about. Rutgers also released another variety called Jersey Gem, which is supposedly in circulation, but no sellers seem to have it. And we've mentioned Ken from Oikos, who's been on the show and has at least 8 selections or lines, as he calls them, that show considerable improvement for folks that want to kind of play the game of rolling the dice with seeds.
Okay, so what you're kind of saying is that, like, there's a lot of legwork done at this point, and we just need to, like, get our hands on those genetics before, you know, that they keep doing that thing where they get lost.
Yeah, where they all go missing, and then, like, 2 decades later, people want them, and the trees were cut down the summer before. Yeah.
Yeah, that.
Yeah.
So maybe, people, if you're interested, now's the time.
Yeah, so if you're buying trees online, if they're not grown from seed, there are really only 4 primary cultivars in production that you'll see, like, consistently at places that sell them. And those will be, like, Eastham, which we talked about, Squibnocket, Hancock, and Rarebank.
It sounds like Massachusetts.
Sounds like Massachusetts. Now, according to a friend of the show, an avid researcher, Pete Krisbacher, who thank you for your help with this, there's at least 23 varieties that are actively out on the landscape and identified, where if you know the right people, you can get cuttings and all that fun stuff. So if you're into that, it's time to get on the forums, Facebook groups, all that good stuff. And like I've said, I think our job now is to find those genetics, to plant them, to mark them so we know where they are, catalog them before they're gone, and before we have to kind of start this whole march all over again.
And again, just like kind of interpreting what Andy is saying here, he is saying go into people's backyards, and if they have a beach plum, question them aggressively. Really, really, really get some good trespassing in, I guess is what we're trying to promote here at the Poor Pearls Almanac.
If you're going to get arrested for trespassing, like, live it up to the fullest extent of that trespassing.
And go take some beach plum cuttings.
Does that make sense? Like, if you're going to be arrested for trespassing anyway, like, you really earn that arrest, right?
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is do illegal things to save the beach plums. This is legal advice.
Yeah. Save our plums, please.
Save our plums. Penny Packers plums. Save them. No? Okay.
No. So I thought that was the stinger. I thought that was the...
That was it? No. So if you guys enjoyed this, you can check out agroecologies.org, where there's all the citations for all this fun stuff. If you want to read old newspaper articles like I do, there's your spot. Go find the Beach Plums article. If you enjoyed the episode but you hate the commercials, you can jump on patreon.com. Go look for Poor Pearls Almanac. Sometimes we do try to get the episodes up early on there. We used to be better about it, but hopefully we're better about it by the time this episode comes out. Otherwise, go find us on social media, and I think that's about it. Matt, thoughts,
hell yeah.
Concerns, complaints, reservations, addendums, anything?
Lots of complaints, and quite a few addendums, but we can get to that off mic.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Go eat a beach plum.
Bye.
Remember to edit out that slurp there, Dom. Apparently he did not in one of the episodes, so it's just me like glugging water.
Wait, what was that? There was one response to it. It was like Giga Chad water mogs like virgin dehydrated listeners.
Oh my god.
Oh my god, I can't believe that just came out of my mouth. I need to like...
Oh my god, Matt. You've come so far.
Oh god. I've slipped so far.
Oh shit.